You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'm flying solo again today as my co-host, psychologist Dr. Melody Fox, is tending to one of her clients. But each week, we will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals and some incredible authors in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today is historical fiction in the classroom. Our guest today is Dr. Sarah Schwebel. Sarah is an assistant professor of English at the University of South Carolina, where she teaches graduate and undergraduate courses in children's literature. Now, she received her bachelor's degree in history from Yale and her PhD in the history of American civilization from Harvard. Now, prior to beginning a college teaching career, she taught middle school English and American history in Virginia and Connecticut. An avid reader as a child, she is a strong believer in the power of children's literature to cultivate lifelong learners and bringing joy into people's lives. Now, having gone from reader to author, we're going to be talking about her new book, Child Size History, Fiction of the Past in U.S. Classrooms. Sarah, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, I've had a chance to read probably about a third of the way through the book now, and I'm really enjoying it. And I think as we discussed a little bit off the air, I was a room dad in my children's classrooms from about kindergarten till fifth grade. And so as I'm reading the book, you know, I'm seeing what it is that you're talking about, you know, from the standpoint of kind of maybe the changes that have happened in the type of books that are available to the kids, how they're being presented to them. I mean, there's so many things that are out there that I didn't really think of while I was, you know, being a room dad, because I was more or less trying to be a helper. But now from the standpoint of looking back, I can really see how the differences between children that are given textbooks versus more of a historical novel can really make a difference and can really help them to become avid readers and readers that are really getting involved in it. And I know that, because even with my own children, I've got, a couple of boys that are now teenagers, but I didn't feel like they really grasped reading like I did. I mean, I'm one of those that, I'm constantly reading something, and I can look at it as a combination of educational and learning something, but at the same time being an escape. So,
right.
And one of the things that I liked, that you talked about in the book was yourself reading some of the Laura Ingalls books, and where you would put yourself in that position. You know, you would see yourself as being them and sort of reenacting it yourself. Share with us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I had both teachers and parents who really encouraged reading and who encouraged imaginative play. So when I read books that I really enjoyed, that had strong characters with whom I identified, often in my case, young girls who were ambitious and playful, and readers, that I put myself in the book and imagined that I was that character. So I talk about in the introduction to Child Sized History having a teacher read aloud the Little House on the Prairie books. And I imagined that I was Laura, you know, the strong protagonist of the novel. And what I did along with a number of my friends in about third grade was we checked out the McGuffey readers from our school library, and we took them with us to the playground to play school. And we also built sort of a house on the playground where we, from the long winter in Little House on the Prairie, it's very cold, and the Ingle family heats their home by tying straw together. So we took pine needles from the playground and tied them together and used those to pretend as if we were building a fire in the school playground. And so, you know, you look back on this and say, oh, you know, that's cute or that's fun. But I think that there's some learning connected to it. So as we were acting out aspects of this novel, we were imagining how our lives would be different if we lived in that time period. So how would school be different? And then we might get to the question of why would school be different? If we were growing up then, we might grow up to be farmers. What kind of skills would we need in those cases? Very, very different skills than we might need today. And so there's some real advantages to that imaginative play. Of course, there are also some disadvantages, which I talk about in the introduction. So the perspective of Little House on the Prairie is very much that of a white settler family. And so while I was imagining myself as Laura Ingalls Wilder, this pioneer girl, it's very hard to imagine what it might be like to be one of the indigenous peoples who were displaced by federal land policy that cleared land for white settlers. So there are both some huge positives of learning history through historical fiction, but also some things that both parents and teachers need to think about really critically when we present literature to young people.
Well, and I couldn't agree more. And as you were telling that story, I mean, the things that I see that come out of it is you know, we're dealing with imagination. We're dealing with, I think, appreciation. I think any time that you're a young person now and you're seeing what people went through at, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, you know, to get water or to get food or to make fire, you know, any of these things that we all take for granted. So I think that there's just so much benefit, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, like I said, using your imagination. Reading then becomes fun, and then you're more excited about reading that textbook that may come off kind of dry. You know, at least you recognize the difference, and you recognize that there can be some real value in even escapism from just sitting down and reading a good book.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's part of what makes reading a joy that you're going to return to during the course of your whole life.
Now, you mentioned the part about some of the stories that aren't told. But, I mean, as time has gone on and as we have added more books out there, aren't we getting more books out there that is now showing the view of you know, of another culture, or the view of someone who was here before us? I recently saw and really enjoyed the movie The Help, which, you know, obviously was from a book. Something like that, giving the viewpoint to people that may not have been able to live that, or maybe hadn't even thought about placing yourself in that position, I think is huge, to be able to see that, you know, let me look at it from
That's
their viewpoint.
Right. That's right. So really, this change came about in the late 1960s and early 1970s in children's literature, and books started to appear that would feature characters who are underrepresented in traditional historical narratives, so in history textbooks. And that includes African Americans, Native Americans, Latinos. It includes women as well, who are marginalized in mainstream historical texts. And so a great advantage of historical fiction is that it can put characters who often are literally marginalized, they're placed in the margins of textbooks in sidebars, front and center. And we know as parents, as teachers, as caring adults, that so important for a child to be able to see him or herself in a book and therefore think of him or herself as a reader, because reading books are about them. They see reflections of themselves in text. And so this is one thing that novels can do really, really well. There are many, many more choices out there now than there were 20 years ago, and certainly than there were 40 years ago. But there's something interesting about the novels that tend to be taught in schools, and that is that teachers and tend to go back to old classics, to old favorites. And so although newer books exist, oftentimes the same works of historical fiction that have been taught in the 80s are still among the most widely taught books in classrooms today. So we still have work to do to get more diverse perspectives into our classroom curriculum.
Now, what percentage of the kids do you think understand the difference between historical novels and what actually happened? I mean, is it?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of my favorite examples is a researcher who was working with elementary school kids and asked them to list some important figures of the American Revolution. And they listed some people you might expect, like Paul Revere, Ben Franklin, and then they also listed Johnny Tremaine. I don't know if that name rings
yes,
a bell for you,
course,
but Johnny Tremaine is the protagonist of this classic work of children's fiction published during World War II called Johnny Tremaine.
Yep.
And Johnny Tremaine is this apprentice in the novel. So in that case, right, the kids completely saw both the real, real historical figures in Johnny Tremaine and the fictional historical figures as one and the same. They couldn't disentangle the two. And so then the question we have to ask is, well, does that matter? Because in some respects, the Paul Revere or the James Otis figure that's in the novel is just as fictional as Johnny Tremaine. In other words, the author, Esther Forbes, created all of those characters. And the Johnny Tremaine character functions as kind of a symbol in the text. And, of course, he's a character with whom child readers are going to identify because he's a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a boy that, despite the fact that he's still a youth, plays an important role in terms of he's influenced by the ideology, the ideas of the American Revolution. And at the end of the novel, he is poised to fight in a war that's going to bring about American independence. So he provides something for kids to grasp onto. And if they understand the character of Johnny Tremaine, then they've learned something fundamental about the way historians have talked about the American Revolution. So they have a hard time mm-hmm. disentangling the fictional from the authentic.
Well, now, let me ask you this. I mean, as we introduced you, we talked about the fact that, I mean, you were also a teacher yourself. Now,
mm-hmm.
At what point did you look at what was going on and say, you know what, I want to write a book myself. You know, I want to call it, child size history, and
right.
and really address what's happening out there.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, I went into the classroom right after graduating from college. So I was a history major. I graduated from college, and I taught 8th grade American history immediately thereafter. And I really wanted to bring the excitement of my own college learning in history to the classroom. And so the first unit I created, we didn't use a textbook at all. I pulled together a group of primary source documents, music, art, to hit key concepts of the turn of the 20th century with my students. And then the last few units I taught with a textbook, because one thing I learned very quickly is that it's very difficult for beginning teachers to create all their resources. You simply don't have the time. And as I sort of hit this, confronted this problem of wanting to do more and realizing the limits of my own knowledge, I realized that to be the kind of teacher I wanted to be for my students, I needed to go back to school myself. So after 2 years of teaching American history, I went back to graduate school and I did a doctoral degree in American studies. And during this time, I took a course on the historical novel, where we looked at just this question you were asking me. So what's the difference between narratives written by historians and narratives written by novelists about the same time period? How does historical fiction capture knowledge about the past? And I went back to reading Little House on the Prairie, and I thought, what had I learned when I was reading all these historical novels as a child? If the author writing the book is influencing the kind of story that's told, then what narratives of American history had I absorbed as I was reading shelves full of historical fiction during my childhood and early adolescence? And as I went back and reread some of the favorite books from my childhood, mm-hmm. I was at times horrified. I'll use that word because it was a pretty strong reaction. And I was horrified because some of what I read, I recognized was so far removed from what historians say about the time period depicted in the novel. So I can give you an example.
Okay.
One of my all-time favorite historical novels as a child was The Witch of Blackbird Pond. And it's a book about a young teenage girl who's orphaned, and she's been raised in Barbados, where she's been taken care of by slaves who, you know, followed her every step, took care of all of her needs. She's orphaned, and she ends up in a Connecticut colony that's pretty stark. And so she has a big adjustment as she learns what it takes to be a good Puritan, which is to work hard, to wear not flashy clothing, to spend hours and hours in church on Sunday. And as she makes this transition, she learns to be a good American as we would understand it in the 1950s. And part of that means rejecting slavery. And so to make this argument in the novel, the author has the character learn that slaves exist mainly down Virginia way, not in Connecticut. But we know for a fact that there are quite a number of slaves in Connecticut at the time in which the novel is setting.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it say? Well, the book, The Witch of Blackbird Pond, conveys a pretty good message. Most of us today would say, well, that's great if kids learn that becoming American means rejecting racism, rejecting slavery. But the reality is, in colonial Connecticut, there were slaves.
Right, right. Now, I mean,
so there's this gap here.
Right. Now, but if you can tell us a little bit more about it, but, you know, if the book imparts a lot of really good messages, I mean, why does it matter if they obscure the harshness a little bit of the past?
Right. Well, it makes it difficult then for kids to understand why we continue to have inequalities today. So inequalities in healthcare, inequalities in education, inequalities in leadership in this country, right? In order for us to understand where we are today in the present, children have to have an understanding of the obstacles that various groups of people had to overcome and often are continuing to have to overcome to reach parity.
Okay. Now, so, I mean, at this point, you know, if we have, you know, and you were mentioning about dealing with the older books, is it better to have more of a balance? In other words, if we have a balance of some of the older books, some of the older classics, so that they get a chance to see at least, you know, something that's been fictionalized, but at least see what some of the old classics have. But at the same time, you know, is it better to have some of the newer books so that they have better choices, you know, for the kids today?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's exactly right. You know, if we can have a balance, that's wonderful. So let's bring in some new books that are in line with current historical thinking and that bring overlooked historical actors front and center. But the old books are also valuable. And I think the best way to understand it is this, right? Many of us learned history in part through history textbooks. And history textbooks tend to be replaced, say, every 5 to 7 years, depending on budget issues in a school, right? And so because they're always updated, they have a kind of status or authority in the classroom as if they're truth, right? And this gets reinforced when kids miss a question on a history test and they go to their teacher and say, why is this wrong, right? The teacher will often say, well, the answer's on page 83. Right? Mm-hmm. And that very question and answer exchange then reinforces the idea that the history textbook is right. It contains the truth, right?
Right.
But none of us learned history from our parents' or our grandparents' history textbook. So that tells us that the narrative we tell about the past, the truth that's in the history textbook, continually changes.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So novels are different because we tend not to replace them. So kids today are still reading Johnny Tremaine. They're still reading The Witch of Blackbird Pond, even if they're written in an earlier period. So when teachers teach these historical novels, they actually have this tremendous opportunity to teach kids about how history is always interpretive, and it's always influenced by contemporary politics. So they can, the novels can make visible what the history textbooks tend to obscure. If history textbooks stand as truth, the novels present themselves as the work of one person, the work of one moment in time, and always interpretive.
Yep. Now, you just mentioned a little bit about political influence, and I think that's a huge issue, and at least for now, it seems like it's getting stronger and stronger. How do we balance that from the standpoint of not letting whomever happens to be in power at any given time start to put such a slant on the books to try to get their own political ideology reinforced?
Yeah, it's a real problem, right? Because textbooks want to be able to sell to particular markets. And big states like Texas and California are able to really influence the creation of textbook narratives because they have so many students, they're buying so many copies. So I think novels, again, provide a nice sort of way to balance out the politics that get inevitably embedded in textbooks. And that is because teachers aren't going to use just one novel to cover this expanse of American history from settlement, pre-settlement, all the way up to today. They need many, many, many works of fiction, all of which are written by different authors, all of whom have different perspectives. And so the best way, I think, to deal with this issue is to make sure that there are multiple voices heard in the classroom and that teachers help guide students in naming the perspectives in the book. So reading a novel and then thinking about what argument is this novel making about the American past? And then why might this author be making that particular argument? And one way that this can be done really effectively is by pairing two or three books that are set in the same historical time period but make distinct historical arguments. So to go back to the American Revolution, it's an easy example. Johnny Tremaine was written during World War II, and it consciously encourages readers to make connections between the War for Independence and World War II as both being fought for the same reasons, for freedom, mm-hmm. for democracy, for equality. And World War II is presented as the good war being motivated by ideology, by ideas. In the wake of the Vietnam War, James Lincoln Collier and his brother Christopher Collier wrote another novel about the American Revolution, and they consciously tried to write a novel that argued against, that in their view complicated the narrative presented in Johnny Tremaine. And they did this because they were thinking about the politics surrounding the Vietnam War and protests against the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
So in their book, My Brother Sam Is Dead, they really question the idea that the war was ideas alone, and suggest that in part it was driven by economic interests of the elites. And it makes the argument that both sides, both the British and the Americans, were quite hypocritical in their dealings. It does not, like Johnny Tremaine, it does not put great emphasis on either African Americans or Native Americans during the war. It's largely a white cast of characters. Flash forward to the first part of this century, the 21st century, and an author, M.T. Anderson, wrote a novel about the American Revolution again, but he made his central protagonist an African American boy. And it makes yet another distinct argument about the American Revolution. So in a classroom, you can put these three novels side by side and ask, well, how come each of these three novels are about the same war, but they're presenting different messages?
Well, and I love what you're doing because it makes great sense. If you have teachers that take the time to present all of three of these, and the administrators are giving them the ability to do this, I think that's going to make the children think, you know, that, okay, first of all, you know, this is not a factual thing. This is three different and unique, you know, opinions of what happened or views of what happened, and it makes them think. So, I mean, I think you're on to something. We're going to take a break real quick. Again, you're listening to Answers for the Family. We are talking with Dr. Sarah Schwebel, and the topic is historical fiction and the classroom. We will be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. We are talking with Dr. Sarah Schwebel, and we are talking about the textbooks and the and books in general that our kids are reading in school today. And we have some listener questions and comments that have come in. So, Sarah, I'd like to ask you a couple of these, and I think they're kind of right on target with what it is that you're talking about. This one reads, I am a fifth grade teacher, and I could not be more supportive of your viewpoint. One of the problems in our district is that our curriculum is pre-selected, and we are prohibited from recommending any reading material that are not on an existing approved reading list. I have made a list of books I would like my students to read, but the powers to be have rejected all of them, stating that they feel there might they might be unsuitable passages that parents would object to. I have polled the parents of my students as to their approval on a couple of the books and got unanimous support, and yet our administrators won't budge. From what older teachers have told me, there haven't been any new books added in about 20 years. I think fear not educating our kids is ruling the day. Have you seen or run into this problem?
It's a great question, and boy, do I empathize. It sounds like a wonderful teacher who's working really hard and thinking very carefully about what kinds of texts would benefit her students, his students. Yes, I have absolutely seen this, and in fact, that's part of what I'm hoping child-sized history will draw attention to. The fact, when I first started research for this book, I could not believe that the same books I had read in elementary school were the books that were most widely taught today. I mean, there's been so much new literature produced in that intervening period since the time I was in fifth grade, now a university professor. And so really what we have is a canon of elementary school and middle school books. A few new titles have been added, certainly, but many of the older books continue to be taught. So I think first, we need to scrutinize those older texts and help administrators see some of the drawbacks of those older titles, and to help teachers and parents see how those drawbacks can, if carefully used, help students become critical thinkers and historians themselves. So in other words, to say, okay, Johnny Tremain has very much an interpretation of the American Revolution that is in line with thinking in World War II, but it has slave characters in the book who talk in dialect. That would never happen. The kind of sort of derogatory language, only on a couple of pages, but in Johnny Tremain, would never fly in a book written today. So let's pay attention to that. So, you know, one thing is that she can help, or he, the person asking the question, can help administrators to see that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Now you just mentioned, you know, you said teachers and parents. I know that we have both that listen, but what can parents do when they're unhappy, you know, with the books assigned in their child's classroom? And to add to that, I can relate to the fact that, you know, I'm blessed with the fact that I am I'm given tons of books. I get books sent to me, you know, from publishers. And some of them, I think, well, this would be great for one of my children. And I set up, I have a little plan with them to where I say, look, I'm going to pay you X amount for you to read this book. I think that you'll like it. And if you write me a, you know, a summary of it, you know, I'll pay you X amount for doing that. Now, I've asked some of the teachers when I thought, you know, this one does have some historical context, and I've asked their history teacher and said, you know, I'm going to have, you know, my son reading this. Can he use that and get credit? I mean, or can he use it to replace one of the books? You know, we were given a list of which books we could pick from. This one isn't on it, but it seems to have some of the same components. And the answer is always no.
Right.
So I go back to the question, which is, I mean, what can the parents do to try to shift this this lack of flexibility in these areas?
Right. Well, I think the first thing is just what you've done, which is to be concerned and to be proactive. I think, you know, the teacher who asked the question spoke a lot about fear, and I do think that administrators are fearful of parents' complaints and about censorship, and that may, in some cases, lead them to stick with books that are tried and true that they haven't had problems with in the past, so they're reluctant to bring in new texts. But I think the problem is that older texts can also have really problematic aspects that can make a child in the classroom really uncomfortable. So I think when a parent hears from their child that they don't like a book, that a book doesn't make them feel good, that the first thing a parent should do is to sit down and read the book with the child and to talk about what aspect of the novel is uncomfortable. It may be that a character who looks like them, racially, ethnically, religiously, in some other way, that is presented in a quite dated fashion. So, for example, I mentioned the African-American character in Johnny Tremain, who speaks in a very offensive dialect. So talk about that, and then empower the child to understand why that's part of the novel, right? Well, you know, Esther Forbes was writing in the 1940s, and that was, remember, before the Civil Rights Movement, and people tended to have different ideas about race than we have today. And so sometimes when a child has the historical context that helps them understand the book, they will feel better, and they can then be a leader in their classroom who both stands up for themselves and says, you know, this is why I don't like this book, even though I recognize its value. And here I want other people to understand why this is offensive, but also to understand why this might be in the novel in the first place. Let's look at when this book was published. And then I think the other thing that parents can and should do is go to the teacher with some alternatives and say, look, you know, I'm not saying that this is a bad book or that this book can't be incredibly useful in your curriculum, but I want you to understand my perspective and my child's perspective. And, you know, the parent mm-hmm. might point them to a book like mine, a book like Child Size History, to help educate the teacher, the administrator, the school, and then perhaps offer some alternatives, some books with more recent publication dates that could perhaps be placed in dialogue with a text that is on the teacher's reading list, so you can read them together.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I mentioned that having been a room dad, I noticed some of the same things. I mean, the books that I read, I mean, when I was a child versus the ones that I was now reading to these children anywhere from kindergarten to about fifth grade. And, mm-hmm. and for any of the parents out there that have been a room parent, you'll know that once they get into middle school, they don't necessarily want you to be a room parent. So I learned quickly. But one of the things that I did notice that, I mean, it seemed that some of the children's books of today were a little darker than I recalled in the past. I mean, as adults, should we be concerned about that or is that something that really is sort of beneficial because it gives a broader spectrum?
Right. Well, it's absolutely true that we are seeing themes, topics in children's books today that really were very much taboo in earlier years, say before the 1980s. And this includes violence, and it includes race-based violence. So an example is Lori Halls Anderson is in the process of writing a trilogy for middle grade readers. So we're talking maybe fifth, sixth, seventh graders, still pretty young, that's set during the American Revolution, and her protagonist is a young African-American girl, Isabel. And Isabel is really being held in slavery by a mistress who is completely unjust and irrational and angry. And she has Isabel branded with the letter I for insolence. And we get a blow-by-blow description of this hot iron being pressed against her skin, the burning of the skin, Isabel in the stocks, feeling faint, being disfigured, right? So that's one example. We also, in another recent book, Copper Sun, which is also about slavery, there's a young African-American girl protagonist, and we learn that she's been repeatedly raped. And we don't get the actual description of the rape, but we see her afterwards. Mm-hmm. So we're getting some images that I think some parents and teachers would find disturbing. And it certainly raises the question, what is the right age to teach children about rape? What is the right age to teach children about how violent slavery could be, about branding, about, say, medical experimentation on bodies? Both African Americans and Indigenous Americans were subjected to medical experimentation. And, you know, I think that's a question that's worth asking,
sure.
And it's worth parents talking about.
I couldn't agree more. Actually, we have another comment that is coming in, so I'd like to share it. And again, I want to say to all the listeners out there, we appreciate your comments, we appreciate your questions. And this one says, history is one of my favorite topics, in particular, the evolution of our own government and its beautifully written Constitution and Bill of Rights. I do believe firmly that our youth would greatly benefit from novels that would help them understand the intent of those documents and instill a passion to recapture the values that many of us believe. Now we're getting political as I'm reading it. that many of us believe are being trampled and negated by career politicians and special interest groups. It says, your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that two things. First is that history, there's no question, has in recent years been downgraded in importance in school curriculum. And I say this because we can look at the state testing that has taken place as part of the mandate of No Child Left Behind, and the subjects that get tested the most often are reading and math. And it just, you know, logically makes sense that the subjects that are tested the most are the ones on which teachers spend the most time because they're ultimately being evaluated by student performance on the test. Mm-hmm. So the result of all this is that history has been given less time in classrooms, particularly in low-performing schools that are on the verge of being marked as failing. So it's something that we as a society should think about. Traditionally, history has been connected closely with civics and has been deemed a subject of great importance for the health of the democracy. And so I agree with this questioner in that I believe strongly that history is really important and that to be a productive member of this society, a productive citizen who is prepared and ready to take on the responsibilities of that citizenship, including voting for our elected officials, you need to have an understanding of the nation's history and the nation's government. So I couldn't agree more with that aspect.
Well, and yeah, me too. So now, did you discover, any sort of new favorite historical novel or anything during your research? In other words, as you're putting all of this together, what did you get out of it that you might not have expected you were going to get out of it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things that surprised me, as I said, was that the same books were continuing to be taught. But I also really found some new gems that I was wowed by. And I'll just tell you briefly about one book that I've become a huge fan of. It's by the young adult novelist M.T. Anderson, and he wrote what I think is a breathtaking two-volume novel with a very long title. It's called The Astonishing Life of Octavia Nothing, Traitor to the Nation, Volume 1, The Pox Party. And then there's also Volume 2. And what this book does is it puts an African-American slave at the center of a narrative about the American Revolution. But this slave has been raised by a group of academicians, so loosely based on what the author calls a sort of dysfunctional society similar to the one that Benjamin Franklin was involved with in Philadelphia. And so this young African-American boy has had a tremendous education. The goal is to give him an education equivalent to that of European princes. So he's super intellectual. He's read Latin, Greek, all the documents that basically inspired the founding fathers, if you will, of American independence. And so you have the combination of someone who has access to sort of all of the current scientific thought of the day, political thought of the day, but who is enslaved. And literally, he's the subject of a scientific experiment to test the intellectual capacity of the African race. So he sees clearly sort of the hypocrisy that is also at the heart of the nation's founding, which is that we have these amazing founding documents that proclaim the equality of people, of man, celebrate liberty, freedom, but also which retain slavery as an institution. And so the book is written in the language of an 18th century intellectual, in Octavian's voice, the slave's voice. So it's both beautifully rendered and challenging for readers, both in terms of diction, prose, form, but also in terms of political ideas. And it can spark endless conversations.
It sounds like it. Now, what age group is in the schools is getting the opportunity to read this?
Right. This is a novel really for older students, so I would say around 11th or 12th graders.
Okay.
It would be a great, say, summer reading selection for an honors class or an AP history class. And I think that's also when we tend to turn away, schools tend to turn away from historical fiction. The kids get a lot of it in elementary school and middle school, but not so much in high school. But I think it has the potential of tremendous value for older students as well.
Well, good. And I have a senior in high school myself, so that may be something we'll pick up for him. And we've got another question that has come in from a listener. This one reads, as a middle school teacher, I see a different problem with my students than the content of the books that we're using. In our soundbite society, I see more problems keeping their attention for an entire novel. I feel we're headed towards teaching from short stories rather than historical fiction. I would like your thoughts on this.
Yeah, well, this is something that I think, teachers are continuing to struggle with. I just, kids are spending a lot of time reading short pieces on the internet, for example. I think that one solution is to remind kids how wonderful it can feel to get lost in a story. And one way to do that might be for a teacher who's facing this issue in his or her classroom is to think about reading out loud to the class, using different voices for narrators if they're able, leaving off on cliffhangers that leave kids ready to come running back to hear the next phase of the story. We recognize, the literature has, recognizes the importance of reading out loud for young children. And my personal opinion is that we tend to stop too soon, and that students can and will be pulled into the magic of the story if given the chance. And I think that once they're hooked on a story, then they can be motivated to read on their own. So maybe it's an issue of reading the first couple chapters as a class and then moving on.
Okay.
I also think one more danger is that sometimes teachers make every chapter too much of a chore. There are too many questions per chapter, and if you move too slowly, then students can also lose interest.
Yeah. I think another battle that we have is, I mean, on the one hand, they would rather have the short story, but I think also with television, and I can recall a couple of years ago, there was one of the books that was one of the choices that one of my sons could have, had also been made into a movie. And so when he and I are picking, he says, well, I want that one. And I said, well, why are you choosing that one? He said, because then I don't have to read it. I can just get the movie.
Yes. A challenge. But you know what? With historical fiction, movies provide another great opportunity for teachers and parents to provide some challenging questions to kids. So, for example, since I've talked about Johnny Tremaine, I'll go back to Johnny Tremaine. Johnny Tremaine, the novel was published during World War II, and the author said, this is my contribution to the war effort. I'm writing a novel, patriotic novel, that's going to help kids understand why we're fighting the war. Well, Disney made a movie version of the film, which is still shown in schools today. Most kids laugh at it because, you've got 1950s special effects. Mm-hmm. But the movie was made in the midst of the Cold War, and it feels like a Cold War movie. So you have a novel which is shaped by the World War II moment, and then a movie adaptation, same plot, different historical argument being made through that media.
Mm-hmm.
So, it can be deceptive to watch a movie in place of the book, which of course we all know, but it also provides a great pedagogical opportunity. How does the book and the movie differ, and how does the historical moment in which these two were produced shape their differing messages?
Well, I just glanced at the clock, and we are almost out of time. So I've got a couple of things real quick. One is that can you share with the audience, where can they either reach you or where can they get the book?
Sure. The book is widely available in online bookstores, so Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Powell.com. You can also go directly to Vanderbilt University Press website, and I would welcome email and comments, questions. You can find me at the University of South Carolina, through the English department. And all my contact information is up on the department homepage.
And that is great. And for any of you that is out there driving and you're not able to write any of that down, if you go to the Answers for the Family website, that's Answers, the numeral for thefamilyblog.com, we will have that information as well. We've got just about a minute, so one last question. What can parents do to encourage children to just enjoy reading and enjoy history? What can we do to really bring that out of them?
Right, great. I mean, I think if you can make it a family activity that you enjoy together, that's a wonderful thing. I have very fond memories of family vacations where we stopped at historical sites, where sometimes we could see the setting of a novel that I'd studied in school. So magical. History museums. And of course, reading out loud, whether that's a parent reading to a child reading to a parent, or popping in a book on CD or through an iPod.
Sounds good. And again, the book is called Child Size History. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us, and good luck with the book.
Thanks. Great to be here with you.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.